are listening to a free version of Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Friday, June 21st, 2019. I'm Michael Brooks. This is a Michael Friday. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We're broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartlands of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On today's program, the great Anna Kasparian, executive producer, host of The Young Turks. We're going to be talking about the week's news and previewing Democratic debates, a new lie about Bernie, and much more. Then the great Corey Pine, author of Live, Work, 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 Die, Journey to the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley, and host of the Not Safe for Work of the New, the News from Nowhere podcast, is going to be joining us with a movie recommendation, maybe some UFO talk, Matt. Apparently, there's a lot of activity in the UFO world.
Yeah, aliens aren't visiting us. Spoiler alert.
Space comrades, I'm here for it.
I literally don't know anything.
Stop getting psyops.
That's what I was going to confront Corey with. Stop getting psyops. I heard a cool story, though, the other day about a dolphin saving a guy's life, but there was no extraterrestrial link. It was just a dolphin being.
And there never will be.
What?
And there never will be.
I said that we know of.
Donald Trump, is he the one keeping us from the greatest catastrophe imaginable in the Middle East? Well, apparently as of now, he called off a strike against Iran. He went on, of course, to blame the successful Obama nuclear deal with Iran for the crisis we're in, but he did call off the strike.
Yeah, the one that matters is me. I'm the only one that matters.
Migrant children described neglect at a Texas border facility in grotesque detail, even as several children have died. The Trump administration argues in court that detained children do not need toothpaste and soap as part of their ongoing war on children and terrorism.
Summer camps.
Tensions run through the Biden campaign as his past working with relationship with James Eastland comes to the forefront. Turns out there might have been some substantive reasons having to do with school desegregation as to why he and the arch segregationist bigot got along so well. The Oregon governor sends police to find missing Republicans. War continues. Saudi-led genocide in Yemen as peace talks have pretty much sort of been fully disrupted. Nancy Pelosi does not have AOC's back in her accurate calling of detention of concentration camps what they are. More than 70 police officers in Philly have been put on desk duty over overt racist and violent content. Britain suspends approval of arms sales to Saudi Arabia. The corrupt justice minister of fascist government Jair Bolsonaro in Brazil, Sergio Moro, is getting grilled in the Senate as evidence continues to emerge of the obvious political imprisonment of Lula da Silva. All that and more on today's Majority Report.
Is all the desk duty in America's police stations being done by overly aggressive racist cops?
Apparently. So if they had to remake Beat Cops, you'd have to turn Sam and Benjamin into nebbish bigots, which would actually be a very fun 2019 gloss on it.
Maybe they're the last cops allowed on the beat because they're not bigots.
Well, that's one angle for one season, which would be hilarious. But then the other angle would be that they're not bigots, but they're scared of going on the beat. So they have to write a bunch of...
Yeah, they're right.
It's just like, I don't know. I don't want to protect these black guys. And then they go to the family Seder and they're like, how could you say that? You were raised to support the civil rights movement. And it's like I don't believe it. You go on the beat.
Or it's just they like to desk duty is such an easy like ride. You just get to collect a check and
right. Know. Right. So every time they're about to get rotated off of desk duty, they have to find a new bigoted thing to write on Facebook.
Probably
I don't know. I feel like we should actually bring the show back here. This is not bad. This has got some potential. So just a reset, and we're going to talk about Iran more with Anna, but Donald Trump ripped up the Iran deal. Mike Pompeo and John Bolton have long sought a war with Iran. The administration in general has a beyond cozy, almost joined at the body with relationship with Israel and Saudi Arabia and other extremist forces trying to provoke this. And they've charged Iran with attacking oil tankers. They've never provided any evidence. They have tried to sort of tell a big lie about Iran al-Qaeda links, even though to the extent that we do have declassified intelligence about Iran and al-Qaeda, it's basically mainly al-Qaeda figures sort of complaining about Iran and Iran basically allowing temporary status for some al-Qaeda people, but not allowing them to communicate with other members of the group and thinking of their own strategic calculation of how to use al-Qaeda. Not to mention the fact that Iran is fighting al-Qaeda-adjacent groups every single day in Syria through its own proxies like Hezbollah. Donald Trump, apparently, he's saying publicly that his concern over 150 people is what led him to call off strikes at the last minute. Obviously, you know, look what he does to children in this country. Obviously, this is nobody who cares about human life. But I do think that this is an area where, objectively speaking, Donald Trump has, I don't know why, but he's got a fear or an anxiety or an instinct or some type of understanding that maybe even just on a workload level, that this would require time and focus. This isn't threatening people on Twitter. This isn't, you know, doing your Cagney impression, before you get on Air Force One. This is really serious, and it absolutely will be catastrophic. And the real fanatics and the real nutcases with regards to these issues, the Pences, the Pompeos, the Boltons, they want it. They don't care. They are happy, obviously, to see plenty of innocent people die in Iran. They're happy to have poor and working class people be sent over there, be killed, have their limbs blown off. They're still in the afterglow of the millions of lives that they helped lose in Iraq. And, you know, Greg Gutfeld, in addition to being very unfunny, is actually a good doorway into the mindset of right-wing, I wouldn't even say armchair warriors. I mean, less than armchair. People like Marco Rubio, who are adults in positions of power, whose understanding of the most important matters of war and peace really do come down to like bing, 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 bing. And, you know, telling like stories to themselves about aircraft carriers. And they think that the world is, I mean, we said that during the debates, during the Republican debates, that literally people like Rubio were just fetishizing aircraft carriers. I mean, to the extent they could get into specifics of anything, it was talking about different weapon systems the way a 7-year-old would if they got to go on their first, you know, naval ship on a tour. It's pathetic and dangerous, but also pathetic and stupid. Here's Greg Gutfeld.
This is now just a video game, and I think that's good news.
I'm sorry, I have to Sam this. I feel like we should just replay it. This is now a video game, and that's good news. So the thousands of people that have died from drone attacks across the globe since Bush, accelerating under Obama and accelerating under Trump, that's good news.
This is now just a video game. And I think that's good news. We're now in a time where it doesn't matter how large your population is, because the population is no longer expendable in war. It's now about the machines that you have. Drones are now replacing bones, Jesse. Yes, I like to do rhyming there. So it'll be stuff versus stuff. And fortunately for us, we have the best stuff. And if we have the stuff up there, doesn't matter what they have down there. We control them if we have a sky of drones. So then how do you retaliate, right? How do you retaliate to something that isn't human? Like, you know, they took $160 million worth of machinery from us. We have to do that, which means either hitting some parts of their navy or refineries or whatever. You find that you retaliate with machines. But I think it's good news because I think we are moving away from hurling bodies at bodies. That's a good.
Can I disagree slightly?
No, you can't.
All right. I mean, look, he's obviously a very dumb guy. And even just the, you know, machines example, Donald Trump was able to understand that as an example, you hit an oil refinery, you will kill human beings. Then that also begs a further question that if we were going to accept the demented logic of this, that security is guaranteed through a swarm of unmanned killing robots hovering over the Middle East, then why do you need to do anything? You're right. You know what? And by the way, it is true that fundamentally Iran poses absolutely no security risk to us in any conceivable remote manner. They have never indicated that they have any desire to hit us in any way, shape, or form. Certainly Hezbollah does not. Forget that's us with the Europeans. Iran has mostly normal diplomatic relations with the Europeans. The Europeans obviously see the United States as the belligerent aggressors in this situation. They have real security and real strategic differences with Israel and Saudi Arabia. Israel and Saudi Arabia pose both profound dangers to Iran, and those are the types of problems and challenges that in a sane diplomatic environment you'd be working out. So, but I mean, in a sick way, he's basically saying once again, yes, Iran actually does pose no threat to us. And so that should be the upshot of all of this, right? They pose absolutely no threat to us. Anybody that says they pose a threat to us is either a mental, you know, is deranged and having fever dreams, is stupid, or lying. And usually, in most cases, all three.
One of the reasons Guernica was so such an atrocity remembered in the Spanish Civil War in the 36 was because they attacked populations for the first time with flying vehicles. So it's not like Gutfeld saying it's no longer on the table. Like, it could be very easily on the table again. And in many parts of the world, it's still very much on the table.
Without a doubt. And also, look at Yemen. There's no question that in a place like Yemen or Pakistan that you could absolutely correlate activity and interest in groups like Al-Qaeda with the fact that for what you is a video game, for what them is their family members getting wiped out in a robot attack that we on the delivery end don't even know the people that we're killing. They could just be fitting a behavioral profile.
And as Brent...
That's so bad. And negative shout outs to all the war hawk liberals with their galaxy brain takes that they're tweeting at Trump that he's like a coward for not just lighting up 150 Iranian people. Like, this one guy tweeted, "You'll never be 1% if the man Obama was," which, like, okay, I got to stick up for Obama for a second and remind everyone that he made the Iran nuclear deal.
That's right.
But also, like, if Obama were to follow through and kill a bunch of people, like, that wouldn't make him good.
Well, of course not. No, the types of total, the absolute idiots on one end, an Adam Schiff who ran with Mike Pompeo's assertions about Iran without any proof, as well as, yeah, I mean, just the kind of garden variety morons that would tweet stuff at Trump. I mean, they are... to say the very least, part of the problem. That's just the liberal version of Gutfeld, which is that the rest of the world, including human beings, flesh and blood human beings, are all just a proxy for your own particular neuroses and fixations that you're working out on Twitter, including whatever the like fucking issues you have about your manhood that somehow Obama and Trump is a dick measuring contest that can be manifested through killing Iranians and, you know, precipitating a catastrophic military engagement. Anybody who's doing that or bringing in the whole Russia piece are stupid, are dangerous, are reckless, are immoral, and should never be taken seriously on anything.
Yeah, here's a good rule of thumb. Don't try to nag Trump into killing more people.
Yeah, I would say that's a pretty solid one. And if you recognize that Trump is a deranged, incompetent racist and so on, you know, probably a good idea to not encourage him to wage a war that could be the most dangerous thing to happen on the planet. Just
and
a thought.
Not that this is about efficacy, but this is a common delusion in the war-liker sort of genre, mm-hmm. which is like we can just do this with our air power, which is what we tried to do in Vietnam, which is it's also what the Nazis thought they could do to Britain.
Right.
We've got the V-1 rocket now.
Right.
We have the best stuff.
We have the best technology. Also, and fucking, I mean, excuse my language, but yes, we killed 3 million people in Vietnam. I mean... We did a quantitative air war, which is a genocidal campaign that was also, by the way, precipitated by a lie about intelligence. Look up Gulf of Tonkin. All right. We got to get to Anna. So let me tell you about who is sponsoring today's show. Time spent in traffic is not exploring, creating, and having fun. Use Boosted to get where you need to be faster. Designed to provide a luxurious experience, Boosted's vehicle-grade electronic skateboards and scooters are the modern solution to your transportation woes. With a 22-mile range and a max speed of 24 miles per hour, Boosted is perfect for both running to the store and traveling across town. And with five options to pick from, including their new scooter, the Boosted Rev, there's a perfect electric vehicle that's tailor-made for you, starting at $61 a month with financing. It's no wonder that Boosted was one of Time Magazine's best inventions of 2018. There's no better time to change how to move because right now Boosted is offering our listeners $75 off of the purchase of an electronic vehicle when you use the code MAJORITY at checkout. Go to boostedboards.com and use code MAJORITY at the checkout to get $75 off of your vehicle. That's boostedboards.com, promo code MAJORITY. At checkout for $75 off. We'll be right back with Anna Kasparian. Welcome back. Michael Brooks on the Majority Report. Joining us now is Anna Kasparian. She is the host, a host, and executive producer of The Young Turks. Anna, thanks so much for being here.
My pleasure, Michael.
So, Anna, we almost had a massive catastrophe yesterday with Iran. It didn't happen mm-hmm. because Donald Trump is like Gandhi and was like, there's 150 people. I shouldn't be joking about this. What do you make of all of this?
This is such an incredible story because, first off, of course, Donald Trump is not Gandhi.
No.
But to his credit, and I never thought in a million years I would give him credit, he seems pretty devoted to his base, and his base does not want these wars. They do not want regime change wars. The American public in general does not want another war. And so he luckily isn't allowing the warmongers in his administration convince him or persuade him to launch any type of military attack against Iran. And even yesterday, after that drone was shot down, and I personally believe that that drone was in Iranian airspace.
Me too.
He really downplayed it, while at the same time, members of his administration were fear-mongering about it.
And what do you – the other thing that's kind of amazing, like yesterday – I had us play a clip of George W. Bush actually after the invasion of Iraq, still basically trying to kind of obscure but also like defend the lies that they were telling about the connections between Iraq and Al-Qaeda before the invasion of Iraq. That's incredible that they're bringing that out with Iran, especially just on a basic level. I mean, Saddam Hussein would not be close with Al-Qaeda because of their very profound differences just in terms of secularism versus like religious extremism. Iran is obviously Shia and Iran is Shia and Al-Qaeda is extreme Sunni. Like, what do you also make of the process of like watching all of these lies and all of this spin and all of this hype? Like, it's like getting debunked in real time in a way.
Yes, yes. So what I find fascinating is politics in America in general is just a completely different ballgame from what it was during the Bush administration. I mean, the Bush administration, of course, lied to the public, dragged us into this preemptive war. And part of the reason why they were able to do that is because Americans were scared. They bought into the fear mongering. We were just attacked, you know, of course, on 9/11. And that type of fear mongering resonated with people. Now we've had, you know, obviously over a decade, over 2 decades of this nonsense fear-mongering and these wars, and people are just smarter now. They're savvier. And you can play the same game for so long until people finally catch on to what the lies are all about. And it's incredible because while there's so much division in the country, the reality is there are some issues that do unite Americans regardless of political ideology. One is the issue that we talk about often, which is, you know, economic injustice. Mm-hmm. But there's also this notion that, you know, there is a military-industrial complex. These wars are pushed by entities that stand to profit from additional wars or perpetual war. And people are just smarter now. They're savvier now. We do have real-time debunking. And what's also different this time around is that our allies are not willing to play ball.
Right.
They're willing to come out and speak out against what the United States is lying about. We saw that with Japan after the oil tanker was attacked, and we're seeing it with some of our European partners as well.
Yeah, totally. And it's interesting. I mean, Macron is a lot like Tony Blair in many ways, which is a total insult, obviously, but he's not willing to Blair it to this level. Like, he's not willing to be Tony Blair for a war on Iran. Just briefly, too, you mentioned that, part of the reason they would lie about the connection between Al-Qaeda and Iran and try, I mean, first of all, I think, as you're right, it's just old school fear mongering. But then it's also that Pompeo was trying to set it that strikes on Iran would be covered under this AUMF, which is the one passed right after September 11th, which they're still using for global drone wars, all of this stuff. And Barbara Lee finally got a sort of, I mean, it will surely die in the Senate, but she actually has been working to end this, finally got it out of the House. I mean, that's some progress too.
Definitely. It's progress, but it should also be a lesson and a cautionary tale for members of Congress, because the reality is, once you're willing to give up congressional power to the executive branch and essentially go against our system of checks and balances, well, that power will be abused by the executive branch. And you also have to consider the unintended consequences in the future. So I'm glad that Congress is fighting back a little more. I mean, Matt Gaetz, of all people, is fighting back and trying to ensure that the Trump administration does not move forward unilaterally.
Yeah.
This is not something that we experienced during the Bush administration.
Right. Yeah, to say the least. But I think one thing that we did experience during the Bush administration that we're still experiencing is, you know, the Adam Schiff's of the world, the, you know, dumb Twitter pundits who think that the right response to Donald Trump not engaging in a catastrophe is to, you know, basically call him like a wuss bag. What is that about? like, how do those people still exist? You know, the same people that are most freaked out about Trump might be the same people pushing the same propaganda about Iran and actually trying to instigate something like this.
Well, you know, obviously everything is political. And sometimes I think members of Congress, Democratic members of Congress, you know, in their effort to, quote unquote, resist Trump, will, you know, make all sorts of stupid mistakes. And the fact of the matter is, there should be positive reinforcement when Trump does something right.
Yes.
So if Trump has decided to call off airstrikes against Iran, you don't go on Twitter and start egging him on. You should give him positive reinforcement. The last thing we need is another war. And so I think partisan politics in a lot of ways has kind of blinded some of these politicians like Schiff from doing the right thing. And I mean, I have no problem giving Trump positive reinforcement when he does the right thing. And I'm obviously a progressive. I don't want war with Iran. And I think the right thing to do is to applaud him and, you know, continue trying to persuade him to avoid this war.
Without a doubt. Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I think, yeah, I mean, and it's also, you know, the other thing I think about people like Schiff is still that so much of DC is still run on this, you know, this axis of like the defense industry and then mm-hmm. just this kind of like foundation that pretty much no matter how reactionary or dangerous they're what they're doing, you know, may or may not be. But right now it really is that Saudi Arabia and Israel are just like the axis of the Middle East. And what's funny about Trump is that on one hand, his relationship with Saudi Arabia and with Israel is totally craven. And, mm-hmm. you know, but I guess it's just his political instinct in this one area where, you know, fair enough, he gets it on some level.
Definitely. Definitely. And back in the day, starting a war in the middle of your administration would probably get you reelected. Mm-hmm. But in this day and age, especially if he's going to go against what his base wants, it could really hurt him politically. I think that's part of the reason why you have people like Tucker Carlson advising him behind the scenes and telling him, don't go through with this. This is a bad idea. Right. And don't listen to the warmongers in your administration.
Absolutely. So I think, you know, this is definitely another area I want to, you know, get into the debates for a couple of minutes. I think, you know, obviously, you got to give Bernie Sanders a lot of credit out of 2016. He pivoted really hard onto foreign policy to the point where he's been the only Democrat member of the Democratic caucus in the Senate in 2017 to vote against Iran sanctions, which was a significant mm-hmm. part of ratcheting things up in this crisis. And then, of course, all of his work on Yemen, which is huge. And of course, the Trump administration is just grotesque in that regard. We're heading into the debates. You've got these two different nights. It's kind of awkward. I think it's pretty hilarious that Marianne Williamson is there and the governor of Montana isn't. And I like that. I'm totally not mad at it because I don't need to hear from him. I mean, what is your kind of general, like, what are you expecting from these debates? What do you think? What would you like to see? What would you not like to see?
Well, I always like to see specific questions and, more importantly, specific answers in regard to policy proposals. And luckily, you know, we do have a number of candidates who have come out with policy proposals ahead of time, and I'm looking forward to that. What I'm hoping is that it becomes abundantly clear to Americans that there are some candidates who are all about political expediency. There are some candidates who, you know, might talk the talk, but they don't walk the walk. And it's just substance. I want to see substance. I want to see real detailed solutions for the issues that we're facing today. And so I think this is my prediction. I think Buttigieg is going to suffer a little bit from these debates because, you know, he's this guy who believes on running based on values as opposed to detailed policy positions. Mm-hmm. Which is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. And so I'm really curious to see, you know, how he does up against some of the candidates who have come out with more detailed policy proposals. I hate the way that the debates are set up in terms of like the number of hosts that'll be involved. I feel like that's just a giant like ego trip that people are having. And yeah, I'm hoping totally. That it doesn't distract from the actual substance from the debates. But honestly, like, I don't want to predict too much. I just kind of want to be open-minded and just open-minded to these candidates. With that said, though, it's getting harder and harder for me to not just outright endorse Bernie Sanders. Like, I want to be fair, right? I want to hear, I want to hear them out. But even before the debates, there have been policies rolled out. There have been votes. There are records we can look at. And there's one person who's been consistent for decades, and that's Bernie Sanders. So
yeah, without a doubt.
So I'm still trying to be fair. But at the same time, look, the mainstream media is not helping, because the more they attack him, the more I want to rally, you know, to his side and defend him, because the attacks are just so ludicrous. And while they attack him with all these like ridiculous smears, they simultaneously make excuses for Biden and his willingness to work with some of the most disgusting people on the planet.
Well, that's the dynamic. And I do want to do this specific debunk with you, because this one that's coming out today about, you know, these comments about Elizabeth Warren and then the Vanity Fair headline is like the quintessential, like, there's a lot of people in the Democratic Party, and obviously amongst the corporate and Democratic elites, it makes sense in a material sense why they have a hatred and a fixation of Bernie Sanders. But then there's also just a lot of people, I mean, you know, who sort of bought into this, almost like, you know, this giant apparatus basically still running the 2016 campaign against him. And I think you have this weird dynamic. And, you know, look, obviously I endorse Sanders. I'm 100% with him. But I think – you know, you have this interesting thing where Biden, they'll make excuses and spin for Biden, even as, you know, even today it drops in the Washington Post. It isn't just that Biden keeps using this example of Senator Eastland, who was one of the most despicable people to serve in the Senate. It's that the reason they had a friendly relationship in the 70s, among other things, is that, and I quote, this is Joe Biden writing to Senator Eastland in June 30th, 1977. I just read this a couple minutes before we went on air. I want you to know that I very much appreciate your help during this week's committee meeting in an attempt to bring my anti-busing legislation to a vote. So they built, I mean, even setting aside what Biden is, you know, dismissing in terms of like just being clear about who this arch segregationist bigot was and the fact that he weirdly keeps using him as an example of civility or whatever other nonsense he's putting forward. No, they did work together in the 70s, and they worked together because Joe Biden was playing on Northeast resentments and racism against progress with race legislation. And, you know, some of the same people are going to minimize that, are going to say, you know, that, you know, I don't know, Bernie Sanders phrased an answer incorrectly on something in 2014. So his whole, you know, his record of civil rights completely erased. And then I think in the middle, regardless of what you think of Warren, obviously Warren, of course, is you know, a good candidate in many ways. I'm having more critiques of her recently, but like she's getting a total pass. So you have this like weird thing where Biden is spun for, even though he's just completely irredeemable. Warren is getting a total free ride. And then with Bernie, it's just constant.
Well, let's keep it real. Yeah. I mean, and this is my speculation, but I think that there's evidence to back this a little bit. So I think that the establishment is purposely propping Elizabeth Warren up and also giving her the passes that you just mentioned. I think that they are doing this to drive a wedge between progressives. And, you know, if it ends up being against Biden and Warren, do you think that the establishment is going to continue giving Warren a pass?
No,
they're trying to divvy up the progressive vote. They're trying to do away with Bernie. And they want to make this race between Warren and Biden so they can effectively, you know, destroy Warren's chances later on. That's the way that I see this. Because the fact of the matter is you have, you know, examples of op-eds written by Third Way, a corporate-backed so-called Democratic think tank, right, that said things like, oh, Elizabeth Warren would be absolutely disastrous with her populist policies. That was just in 2013, not too long ago. And now all of a sudden you're seeing them prop her up. Do you think that they changed their minds? Do you think the corporations and the bankers that fund them and their stupid think tank genuinely changed their minds and now think that Warren is going to be a great candidate? No, they want to drive that wedge. And it's, for me, it's incredibly transparent.
Yeah.
Now, that's not to say that Warren is a terrible candidate. I think that she has some policies that are fantastic. My favorite policy is what she wants to do when it comes to student loan debt. But with that said, you know, if you compare Bernie and Warren, Bernie has some significant strengths that Warren lacks.
I agree with that completely. And everything you said, including the fact that, of course, they'll shiv her, you know, when given the opportunity. But I do think it's, you know, in the beginning of the campaign, you would read profiles and the Wall Street people would say anybody besides Sanders or Warren. Now mm-hmm. they're saying, you know, and the true hatred is on Sanders. And I think it's because even though they, of course, they don't like Warren, and of course it's disingenuous because she does have genuine bona fides on Wall Street and finance, which are super important. The systemic nature of what Bernie is offering, they understand there is not a place for them in it. You know, even down totally. To like people who are just like failed Democratic consultants. And so you will see a complete war on him and just this relentless disingenuousness. And I want to just, we'll just do this one quick debunk because this is just incredible, right? Like we're already at the phase where, you know, Bernie says the sky is blue and like that's proof that he's a secret reactionary. Like it didn't take that long for this level of BS about him. So Bernie said in a conversation, I don't actually know the original source, but this is tweeted by Marissa Barrara on Twitter. And Bernie said, I think there are a certain number of people who'd like to see a woman president and a woman elected. And I understand that, which, you know, okay, empathetic, mm-hmm. objectively true. Then he added, Elizabeth's a friend of mine, and I think she's running a good campaign, right? So this is like, okay, so first we have him making an objectively correct statement and then a courteous comment about Senator Warren. Vanity Fair headlines, Sanders, Warren is surging because she's got ovaries. I mean, wow.
Vanity Fair has been doing a hatchet job on Bernie Sanders. That's one example. One other example was a story that I came across, and I tweeted it out with the question, how is this objective? Because in the piece, the writer, I believe her name is Tina Nguyen, wrote something like, you know, Bernie Sanders is like this old, you know, old, undesirable socialist from Vermont. I'm paraphrasing what she said, but not by much. I mean, right. It was such a giant insult. And this was not an op-ed piece. This was supposed to be objective journalism. And that very piece was comparing Warren and Bernie Sanders. I don't understand why that kind of stuff just flies in the field of work that we're in. If you're supposed to be objective, why are you including, you know, your opinion about who Bernie Sanders is or how undesirable he is? It's just, it's gross.
Vanity
Fair, I actually like the reporting that they did previously. And this time around, it's pretty bad.
It's 100. And I think that is also where, you know, you're going to need to start. Like, I think the Warren campaign does need to be held accountable for some of this relative to Sanders, because Sanders consistently, and I know that people got all triggered because there was one tweet where Bernie Sanders put out a tweet, you know, basically saying like, look, this Politico piece is basically showing the third way is warming up to Warren and so on, which I agree with you is totally dishonest. But that for purposes of this campaign, it's true that like at the end of the day, the main enemy of all of these forces of corporate and political malfeasance, they hate Bernie Sanders. He's their enemy number one because he offers the most systemic challenge. People freaked out about it, tweeted at him and complained about it. And it's like, okay, you know, fair enough. I don't agree. I think it's a perfectly legitimate thing to point out. But in general, Sanders goes out of his way and the campaign's been incredibly civil. I think that if we're going to start being so nitpicky about everything, we have to say like, hey, maybe the Warren campaign should put out a thanks Vanity Fair. We appreciate it, but there's no need for this sort of like weird ageist, borderline anti-Semitic editorializing to go along with praising us. You could just praise the senator for her good work. You know, like if that's the game we're going to play, then Warren's campaign should be accountable as well.
Yeah, you know what? That's actually a really great point. So I think progressives absolutely should apply pressure, you know, not in a hostile, angry way, because I don't think that you accomplish anything that way, but apply some pressure to have her speak out, because, you know, these attacks against him are beyond unfair. And the tweet that got everybody so upset, including Chrissy Teigen, didn't even name Elizabeth Warren. I mean, Elizabeth Warren was not named in his tweet. The reason why he shared that story, that Politico story, was because there were quotes from the VP for Third Way indicating that, you know what, anyone but Bernie. So he's essentially saying, cat's out of the bag. They're against me. They're fighting against me specifically, and they're trying to prop other people up, which is, look, these same mistakes were made the first time around. Voters do not want an establishment Democrat, period. So, I mean, the way that this is all going makes it clear to me that these goons would much rather have Trump reelected than have a real progressive in office.
Hundred. When it comes to a group like Third Way, which is, you know, just like, you know, total mediocrity, corporate laundering nonsense, I mean, 100%. Because as soon as, yeah, you know, because their scenario is, you know, yes, best case scenario, you elect a Joe Biden or some other candidate that will, you know, push through legislation for all of the banks and pharma and, you know, whoever else funds these awful places. Or Trump gets elected and then we get to say, well, the reason was that Democrats didn't propose compassionate debtor prisons, and that's our new initiative. And then, you know, here's like our next campaign to make the party more corporate, more reactionary, and worse for people. And, you know, and that, and Sanders is fundamentally antithetical to that. And that's why, you know, frankly, it's, you know, and obviously this is different because I think like the Sanders campaign understands you need to support an independent media and so on. And he's never going to demonize media in the same way as, but it's like, you know, you just MSNBC, Vanity Fair, like these, they're not trustworthy sources for covering covering Bernie Sanders at all. They're not. I mean, you know,
yeah,
frankly,
absolutely.
I mean, look, if you're looking for a fair shake for Beto O'Rourke, then you probably shouldn't watch like MR, you know, like fair enough, but let's just be like transparent about this stuff. The mainstream media, you know, from the weird Politico articles that somehow like Bernie Sanders cleaning up his credit score reveals like his secret Jewiness, but also how could you be a socialist who wants to have like indoor plumbing? I mean, it is bizarre. Right. It's relentless. And all of these outlets are not to be trusted with coverage of Bernie Sanders. I mean, that to me is very
clear.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So I think the progressive wing of the Democratic Party understands that, but I always try to be cognizant of the fact that we're in our bubble.
Right, totally.
And so the important thing is to try to get this message through to the larger Democratic Party. And I'm talking about voters. I'm not talking about, you know, elected officials. I just want them – and it's hard because there's been such a successful campaign to blame Trump's election on Bernie Sanders. So there are Democratic voters, and I'm just guessing, like, Chrissy Teigen is probably one of them, who think,
yes,
well,
if
it weren't for Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton would have been elected and we wouldn't be in this mess in the first place. But that's just not true. I mean, so many young voters were like, no, I'm just not going to go to the polls. I have nothing to vote for. And that's really the heart of the issue here. You know, we got to give people something to vote for, not something to vote against, which is Trump. That's not enough to persuade people to go to the polls.
100%. And you know, and all the reporting that we have available basically is that even though Bernie Sanders has totally different politics from Hillary Clinton and there was no love lost between those campaigns for obvious reasons, that he worked his ass off to get her elected president. He was flying
Absolutely.
Across the country and giving good advice that was ignored by their terrible campaign.
Yeah. And I don't know if you saw it, but just yesterday, Bernie Sanders issued a challenge to Third Way because, you know, there's always this pressure for him to unite the party, unite the party, unite the party, do what you can to make sure that, you know, we're not attacking one another, unite the party. And so he's saying, all right, so let me ask Third Way, if I get the nomination, are they going to back me? Are they going to defend me? Are they going to fight for me? And of course, I mean, look, we can suspect what the answer is. But I love that he brought that up because he did fight to get Hillary Clinton elected to the detriment of, you know, his own fan base. Like there,
right.
there were people who kind of turned on him as a result of that, but he felt it was the right thing to do. And it sucks because he was in a lose-lose situation. You know, you can't let someone like Trump get elected, but at the same time, you know, the optics of backing Hillary Clinton after, you know, that incredibly tumultuous primary season was difficult for a lot of his voters to stomach.
Absolutely. And we've got a couple of minutes left, and I want to talk with you like just a little bit about this documentary that just dropped on Netflix. I think it's called At the Edge of Democracy. And
yes.
I don't know. I have to say, I mean, Matt was joking with me, and I won't name any names, but he's saying that I'm having my victory lap moment on the Brazil story, which I mean, honestly, it's not that satisfying for me because Lula is still in prison. But tell me what you and this monster is still in office. But it's a new, I mean, tell us about the documentary, what you think of it, and just kind of, you know, especially in light of all the Intercept reporting. We've talked about this for a while, so I just want to know what you think.
Yeah, for sure. So I thought it was a great documentary. There were little bits and pieces throughout that I was unaware of. So I thought it did a good job in informing me. And if I felt that way, I think others who knew nothing about what happened to Lula would be, you know, certainly more aware of how a democracy can completely crumble. So look, it was kind of terrifying as well, because the parallels between Brazil and the United States, I always recognize them, but it's even more specific than I previously realized. So the fear-mongering about transgender people, you know, that we saw that with the right wing here in, you know, America, and that certainly happened in Brazil as well. And also, look, once you get the results you've been fighting for as a progressive, once you get the economic justice that you fought for, the real lesson here is that the fight has to continue, because the second you get complacent, you know, you have this right-wing movement growing behind the scenes, and they're going to overthrow the system that you fought for.
Totally.
So,
yeah.
So my point is, like, there's always going to be suffering. There's always going to be a fight, because these goons in Wall Street, these bankers, these corporations, the military-industrial complex, they're not going to give up. Let's say in a perfect world, we get Bernie Sanders and we get an effective Congress, a Congress that actually, you know, works with the executive branch and passes legislation that provides Medicare for all, that provides a Green New Deal, that provides all of these things that we want. You think that bankers are just going to sit back and take it? Of course not. They're going to rally the troops. They're going to do what they can to fight back, and they're going to play dirty. So we always have to be on guard, on alert, and we have to keep fighting. That's really the biggest lesson I learned from watching that documentary.
Yeah, I agree with you 100%. And I mean, it really will spell out. I mean, again, I think anybody who has, you know, any ability to sort of look at this analytically, and now obviously with the Intercept reporting, I mean, it's, you know, if you don't understand that Lula is a political prisoner, you're, you know, I don't know what, where you're not, I don't even know if you're out to lunch, you're out to something else. But, you know, the process of watching how Dilma was impeached, and just one, it was, is also incredible. And one of the scenes in the movie that really stuck with me, though, is when the filmmaker is in the back of the car with Lula and his wife after Dilma's been impeached. And she's like, you know, are the things that you regret, basically? And Lula's kind of just like, you know, which I think is so true, is basically like, you know, the priority was to make people not hungry, which he achieved. I mean, huge reductions in poverty. And he's like, look, yeah, I wish I did more. Nine families basically control the media in this country. And we ended slavery 100 years ago. And there's so many systems here of oppression. But, you know, it's like, it's – and the same thing he told Glenn Greenwald recently, which is like that we are definitionally a victim of our success. And, you know, like that's what enrages these people, even though they did well, even though we were conciliatory. And I think when you add the U.S. dimension, which I have no doubt is there, of, you know, the fact that all of these corruption investigations have basically led not only to the imprisoning of Lula, but basically to the destruction of these incredibly important state companies that provided a huge amount of social money for social programs, jobs. And we know, going back to the Snowden revelations, that the NSA was aggressively spying on Petrobras. So, I hope people will get really real about this story and, you know, demand other candidates join Bernie Sanders and people. I have no idea how people like AOC have not immediately demanded his release, especially in light of the Intercept reporting. It's pretty.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I mean, look, I think AOC has a lot on her plate. So I don't think it comes from a place of malice or anything like that. Maybe she's not even really aware of the latest reporting. I have no idea.
Right.
But I will say this, you know, there was one part in the film where, and this is the part that I think you're alluding to, where Lula's giving a speech and he does talk about all the successes of Brazil, like, and, you know, the gold mining and all the wonderful resources in the country. And then every time he lists a success, he follows it with, but our people are still hungry.
Yep.
And that part of the film, just hearing him speak, and he's a wonderful speaker, it made me really emotional because living in Los Angeles every single day, it's the most painful thing to walk down the sidewalk and see how many people are living in tents. You know, a lot of them you can tell they don't have mental health issues, although there are many who are homeless in LA with mental health issues. Some of them are newly homeless because they've been evicted or pushed out of their neighborhoods due to gentrification, due to, you know, rent-controlled housing being demolished for these luxury apartments. And right now we have 111,000 empty units in LA, and we have 60,000 homeless people. Right. Like, what? How does that make any sense? Like, we don't take care of our own. And that's essentially what he was saying in that speech. And it just really hit me hard. He was always fighting for the right things. And sometimes when you fight for the right things, you got to play ball with the deplorables to get it done. And I'm not talking about, you know, the Joe Biden route of working with segregationists. I'm talking about, hey, this is the system that I'm dealing with. And unfortunately, I have to deal with this system and play ball with this system to get the main priority in my, you know, in my entire like objective done. And for him, it was feeding the hungry.
And that's why he goes and then it's reported in this idiotic, like, ooh, it's corruption. Meanwhile, literally what you're saying is, well, there's plenty of people in Brazilian politics, mostly on the right, who literally are corrupt in the sense of like being like mafia members. But Lula accommodated a system to deliver huge gains for people, and it was covered here as just generic corruption in a way that aided fascism in Brazil. And the last thing I'll say is that other great line he has where he's like, if Jesus came back and had to govern Brazil, like, his vice president would be Judas. Like, that's the mm-hmm. system. And, you know, people need to understand that. And yeah, it's a really powerful thing to watch. And Anna, I super appreciate your advocacy on this, obviously. And we'll talk again very soon. Do you have anything else, final parting shot on Joe Biden that you want to get in?
No, not on Joe Biden. I mean, there will be plenty of opportunities for that. I will say, though, I really appreciate, you know, the show you guys put together, not just Majority Report, but your show. I don't have a lot of time to watch other content. You know, I'm usually producing all day long. But, you know, you guys provide an entertaining way of learning about what's going on in the world, including some of these international stories that get no attention in American press. So thank you for having me, and thank you for the work you do.
Anna, thank you so much. Talk to you soon. Much appreciated.
Talk to you soon.
All right, guys. Edge of Democracy. I would definitely recommend watching it. She has pretty, I think even if you're just interested, like a kind of politico, you know, that type of like access to the main players is pretty fascinating to watch. I'm just going to call, just confirming with Corey that I'm going to call him in a minute. But yeah, let's take a brief break and we'll come right back with Corey Pine. Welcome back to the Majority Report Casual Friday. Joining us now is Corey Pine, freelance journalist, author of Live, Work, 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 Die, A Journey, Die, A Journey to the Savage Heart of Silicon Valley, also host of the News from Nowhere podcast. Corey, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me, Michael. It's been a minute.
It's been way too long, although you and I actually... Wait,
you did my show recently.
I did your show recently. We did a, but it was mainly we were doing an Art Bell impression.
Oh yeah, I think that one is unlocked because most episodes are locked, but I believe that one is unlocked. So please go check it out. I got a really good response from that.
No, and that
you
was
did
really fun.
Excellent as Communist Art Bell.
Communist Art Bell. Well, you know, it's funny because I knew enough to know who Art Bell was. It was this sort of like. Pretty famous, like he was interesting because I guess he was like a conspiracy AM talk show host, but his kind of shtick was like he almost didn't necessarily believe in all of the conspiracies. He just sort of like had like an open line for guests and callers that were really into that stuff, and he certainly didn't
like, unscreened calls, and that's just what people, you know, he was kind of interested in it, and that cultivated that in his audience. I think his main thing was he didn't want to do politics because it was the 90s, you know, and like right. Rush Limbaugh was starting to get popular, and there was a big push to do right-wing talk radio, but you know, rather than go like an Air America route, I think Bell was more of a libertarian, you know, but an inconsistent one.
I looked him up. I looked up his, and I mean, not that it means much, but I do think he endorsed Obama at least once. So I don't know that his politics were not great, but they were not like totally retro. Like they weren't what you might think when you think conspiracy theorist AM talk show host in Arizona.
Wasn't his main concern. You know, I think he was doing an entertainment program first and foremost.
But what's funny about it and what I got into with my impression was my angle in it was that, and it makes total sense. I mean, obviously people who listen to this show will know I have all the sympathy in the world for this, but he not super patient with his callers. So there's just like montages of Art Bell. And it is really funny because there's calls like, Art, I'm wondering if you think the pyramids are not actually an alien honing device, but a false flag for uranium mining. And he's just like, where are you calling from? You didn't identify yourself. You're an idiot. Like he's actually makes me it makes me both appreciate how great most of our callers are and makes me look super patient.
Have a good stable of regular and irregular callers, I gotta say.
Regulars are like show part. Like those are not – like the regulars we have are so good that they're not even like – you know. I mean it's just the occasional like – I mean, you know, sometimes you – I mean first you get like your libertarian idiots. Then you have like your, you know – are you anxious about something I'm anxious about? And if you're not, I'm going to get pissed call, which I just don't have much of a threshold for, you know?
I hear that. So are we doing a movie recommendation?
Well, we're moving. Well, actually, we're going to talk about a few things though. Cause we were going to do a little bit of climate doom, but we're also going to do a little bit of UFO stuff just for Matt.
And by the way, they are related.
Which one?
Climate doom and UFOs. Oh,
yes, definitely.
I'm very interested to hear your theories about this, Jamie. But
so let's do a little UFO.
Okay, we can start with that. I mean, I actually think the UFO thing, since we started with Art Bell, it's a good segue.
Yes,
I think it's probably the most hopeful story out there right now. Although, you know, people are very cautious about it and rightfully so, because I don't think anybody really knows what's going on.
But Matt's very confident that he knows what's really going on.
Let's hear it.
No, I've got an open mind. I'm listening.
No, you don't. What do you think is really going on?
We have a journalist
Matt
on the phone.
Matt doesn't want to believe.
We have a journalist on the phone.
I don't believe that there's little green men, but let's hear what Corey has to say.
Corey, men.
Just to recap a couple of the stories that came out in the last week or so, there was Politico had a story about members of Congress getting classified briefings about the UFO issue. A lot of this kicked off by the last New York Times story, not the one from whatever a year and a half ago, that really sparked people's interest. But a more recent one about Navy pilots that had been encountering these mysterious craft. So some people in the Senate, including Intelligence Committee minority senior member Mark Warner, have received classified briefings on what these things may have been. Prudent on their part, probably, because we're talking about craft that objects, I should say. We don't even know if they're craft, but objects that elements of the military and intelligence agencies are effectively confirming are real. And these things, you know, have been sighted by trained observer pilots. They can do incredible things like accelerate.
Matt?
Also tracked by some of the most advanced, radar and sensors that the U.S. has. So some of the most advanced tech in the world. These things go like 0 to 25,000 miles an hour instantly.
They're made by China, dude. That's my guess.
Okay, a lot of people are.
Have you seen the zoom on their phones?
Yeah. Look at their zoom quality. They do freeform climbing videos and GoPros on things that are taller than the Empire State Building for fun. Okay, this is China.
So that's okay. China. So here's my. A lot of people. This is like the reasonable speculation, right? The serious person speculation is that, oh, this is some classified military program, if not America's, then some other countries in the world. Right. I'm pretty skeptical of that as an explanation because, one, there's no evidence to back it up. There's been no leaks about this kind of thing. Not saying it's an impossible explanation, but if you're going to propose that it's some secret tech that's been cooked up somewhere in the world, like let's hear an explanation of what you're actually talking about.
Well, Xi Jinping is a great leader who has an excellent plan for harmonizing the Chinese system. I'm not sure what part you don't understand of that, Corey.
I think it's Juche thought, probably. Juche
in action. Yeah.
Well, anyway, these things are demonstrating, non-Newtonian physics. Basically, they don't abide by, physics as we're all taught about it in school. So the question is, what allows these objects to perform like that? And I think that whatever the answer is, ultimately, there are hints that there's some potential energy source out there that could help with not only our climate problem, but a lot of other problems we're facing. So I think that's why I say it's the most hopeful story going. The other development was Trump was asked about it by George Stephanopoulos, and he said, our pilots are great. They saw whatever they saw, but I don't believe that this is happening. So if Trump doesn't believe,
I like is that that's basically my response. Yeah. That's pretty much me and Matt's
response. Right.
Like, hey, look, the pilots are great. They do a great job. It's supersonic. That's great. Totally don't believe it. Wait, do we have this? Yeah. Okay, we're going to play this really quick.
Play the clip. Yes,
yeah.
And the president for the first time spoke about being briefed on this subject.
You and I, we know we disagree about that, but we have a whole day ahead to go on this. Before we go, one of the things you have as president is the access to all the information in the world, all the mysteries out there. And I was just struck in the last couple of weeks, we're reading more and more reports of Navy pilots seeing lots and lots of UFOs. Have you been briefed on that? What do you make of it?
I have. I think it's probably... I want them to think whatever they think. They do say, I've seen and I've read and I've heard, and I did have one very brief meeting on it, but people are saying they're seeing UFOs. Do I believe it? Not particularly.
Do you think people know if there were evidence of extraterrestrials?
Well, I think our great pilots would know. And some of them really see things that are a little bit different than in the past. So we're going to see. But we'll watch it. You'll be the first to know.
What an incredibly reassuring answer from the president. Awesome.
No, it's all the facial expression.
This is the moment he became president.
Yeah, that's the moment he became our president. You know, for some reason with UFOs, it's like the opposite of astrology. I'm super on the skeptic end of this one.
Okay, let's say it's aliens. And people are like, why don't they just announce themselves? Like, why don't they land on the White House lawn? It's like, can you imagine if you're an alien and you come all that way and it's like, okay, time to announce ourselves. And you're looking around and it's like Donald Trump, whoever's in charge of the United Kingdom now, You know, I mean,
the brand
is not
them.
Strong. Brand is not strong. All right, Jamie, what is the what's the thing? What's it called?
Posadism.
Okay, what? Give us the Posadism.
So
angle
I myself am not an expert on Posadism. I just want to preface it with that. Our producer AP Andy at the Antifada is, however, currently writing a book about Posadism. It's true. He is. You can find him at Space Pearl on Twitter.
I don't think so in terms of I think you do have some expertise.
Oh, well, yes. I mean, I've picked up some through the time that I've been doing this with Andy, especially since he launched his side project, Prolet Cult, which if you like commie Art Bell, that's basically what Prolet Cult is.
Sir, you're a pretender.
So, Jay Posadas was basically just a regular Trotskyist for most of his life.
Right.
However, he got into some wackier theories towards the end, and people kind of picked it up and ran with it since then, especially right now, because there's an element of catastrophism to Trotskyism that really appeals to people at this moment in time for reasons I can't possibly begin to understand. Just kidding. So the idea is the space comrades are here. They're watching us. And if they've evolved past the point, if they've evolved to the point where they can have interstellar travel, right, then they've probably evolved past capitalism, which was the bottleneck during which they would have destroyed. Yes.
They evolved past capitalism.
Yes.
Surprise,
during
surprise.
Which was the bottleneck during which they would have destroyed themselves and their planet. Now, if they somehow are capitalists, then we should be very scared of them. But
If they're capitalists, I hope people are getting fit because we're going to have to go to some fucking mining situation somewhere. He was like, your Yang bucks are not coming. It's your job. You got some work ahead of you.
Yeah, no, absolutely. But
that would be actually, if you were capitalist aliens and you wanted to find like your first group of expendable humans to wipe out, you should just do the Andrew Yang mailing list.
Oh, my God.
I'm just kidding, for efficiency.
The rest of us might get taken along with them.
No, we would eventually, but I'm just saying if it was like, hey, these are probably not going to be cooperative people in conditions to go work on interstellar salt mines.
Yeah.
Probably video game players that are building a policy set on $1,000 a month to play video games would probably be pretty high on the target list. I'm just speculating and joking. Calm down, people. Relax.
I think a lot of how people conceive of aliens, especially Americans, is projection on our part.
Oh,
right?
Definitely.
Because
they're always assholes.
Yeah. Like, oh no, there's some voracious race of creatures that just uses up all of the resources in a given landmass and kills everyone and moves on. Like, who does that remind you of?
Or they're like really pretentious, like sort of nice, but way unnecessarily convoluted and complicated. Corey, what do you think, man? You think, well, no, honestly, give us your broader...
And maybe we need a solution to it that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility.
That's Jay Posadas right there. But, that's what he said.
But right, the solution that risks the imagination of a new kind of possibility, by the way, is communism, and the space comrades are waiting until we're ready, and, you know, hopefully they're going to uplift us to communism with the help of the sea comrades, of course, the dolphins, before we do column B, path B to communism, which is a lot less desirable, which involves just a total global nuclear war.
Wait, path A is the space comrades?
Mm-hmm. Okay. That's the good one.
Communism is never happening, folks. What is the, I guess we regret to inform you.
I'm sorry.
Well, that's...
Let me just say that I would should look for some good pragmatic third-way leadership to steal us forward. But no, what do you think, Corey, of it all of it?
I think that Space Comrades is at least as plausible as Secret Weapons Program. That's where I'm at right now.
Are you serious? Like, what are you actually saying here? That's wild.
Well, I'm saying here's my sort of takeaway. I do think that, you know, I've sort of been mulling, like, what's my next book going to be about? I think I'll do something on this subject because
I think so
it's
too.
Endlessly complex and fascinating. And I started out doing a magazine piece like a year ago, more than a year behind deadline. And I just can't – I kept reporting because I couldn't figure out the hell's going on. So I've talked to all kinds of scientists. I've talked to military people. I've talked to people that think they were abducted by aliens, blah, blah, blah. All kinds of people. I think there's a lot more to it. I think it's silly to write it off. I think what we're seeing is some kind of government acknowledgement. Certainly, I mean, we've already seen that, a government acknowledgement that they've been studying this more seriously. I mean, I've talked to people, academic researchers and others, who have been looking at this sort of on the down low because it's such an easy subject to mock. But,
right.
You know, with these sort of confirmed sightings by the military, we're basically getting an acknowledgement that there's more to it. And I think that part of the reason that they might be acknowledging it more is that there are more sightings. And, you know, that's as far as
I mean, not saying that this is it, but I mean, we do know that there's a history of intelligence agencies literally feeding and spreading disinformation on UFOs to obscure weapons program. I mean, so just I agree with you. You shouldn't just say, oh, well, this is clearly that again. I buy that, actually, all kidding aside. But I mean, we do know the history here. I mean, doesn't that play into the analysis?
Here's where I'm at. I think that not only is something happening in the sky and that, you know, nobody's prepared to explain at this point, there is also a history of government disinformation that's probably also happening, right? Mm-hmm. So it's possible. Let's say that you're the – here's a theory. I'm not saying that this is what's going on. But let's say that you're in charge of the world's most powerful economy and military, and there are objects buzzing around the sky that are way beyond anything that you control or any other sort of country run by humans controls. How are you supposed to deal with that reality without people really freaking out? Right. I mean, it's something that essentially undermines like the government's claim to authority and legitimacy if it's happening and they can't explain it, because if you can't explain it and people are jumping to conclusions like ETs, then what are you really offering in terms of security or stability? I mean, I think it really, you know, the existence of these objects really threatens what we understand in not just, you know, government, but every field of knowledge, from physics to psychology, all the way down to biology and medicine. I mean, I think that this is something that is put, as you know, Jamie was sort of indicating, is potentially revolutionary in a way. Maybe not because it's space comrades, but because it's going to upend our understanding of science and you know, basically where we sit in the universe.
You could have just been reading the Vedas to already understand that we don't have a correct understanding of this stuff. That's what I do.
Well, the
Jesus
other thing,
Christ, guys.
The other thing that
would be Modi. That would be Modi take.
Well, I'm like a leftist Modi. That's why I'm so hard on Tulsi Gabbard. Nobody gets me.
Well, yeah. The other thing that's so so relevant to
communist Hindu right here.
Indeed.
And Buju socialist. All right, go ahead.
The other thing that's so relevant about what you just said, Corey, like the possibility of a new kind of science, a new kind of energy source, is the preconditions necessary to build communism would probably involve some kind of new limitless energy source, like the Star Trek replicator, to abolish scarcity.
Two things. One, a stray observation, and then I want to know about what the dolphin thing is. But I think Mike from Florida, shout out to you, buddy. I'm sure you're loving this conversation. Jamie, what is the dolphin part of the story? What is their role in all of this?
You know, I'm not super well versed in the dolphin stuff, and you know, more.
You seen Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy? Sorry,
I actually haven't.
I might have read it when I was a kid.
What is that? So is that the same as Posadism, Corey?
No, I don't think so. I'm not the expert on Posadism, although I look forward to Space Prol's book.
I will read that.
In Hitchhiker's Guide,
doing an illicit history of dolphins,
they were the more advanced life form on Earth. It's just that we didn't know.
Yep.
Then bring this in relationship to, before we get to our movie recommendation, of just the absolutely dreadful news that we have on global ecological catastrophe, Corey, because I know that you're working on a roundup for your show of just where we're at with that.
Yeah, I was on vacation for a few weeks, and there was just so much bad news. I had to put all the climate news in one episode that I'm going to be recording shortly. So the biggest headline was that the permafrost is thawing 70 years sooner than scientists thought it would, the Arctic permafrost, which is really bad because that a lot of methane stored in there, and the release of that is only going to accelerate the climate change effects. So, you know, my question is, and I don't have an answer for this, is if that projection was 70 years too optimistic, what about the other projections that we've been hearing related to climate change? Because this is sort of the critical one. I put that question on Twitter and somebody said, oh, it means the canary is dead. And I think that that's pretty much the takeaway. And we are already seeing accelerating effects. I mean, Chennai, the sixth largest city in India, is out of water.
Yep.
Literally out of water. I mean, they turn on the taps and nothing comes out. And they've been having to get trucks come in. And even that is becoming untenable. And that is going to get more so and more so. I mean, another headline recently, last couple of weeks, Himalayan glaciers are melting at like twice the expected rate. And that's the water supply for a billion people. So
how do we balance, like, my question with covering climate change is always, I mean, I always have a couple of questions. One is the kind of, you know, basic argument, which I think is, you know, at least obviously, you know, on shows like this and so on, there's, I think, a better understanding that, you know, the climate question is ultimately not a question about whether or not people believe the right things or, you know, that type. Obviously, public disinformation matters, but that fundamentally we're not taking this on because there isn't a critical mass of people that are like, well, I read the BBC summary of the report and by golly, this is bad. It's because of, I mean, at the end of the day, I think it's undeniable that it is about capitalism. I mean, it's you cannot have the growth incentives without, you know, you need a redesign in the structure of the economy in order to do this. And then if you want to take it to like a set, you know, a less fundamental level, the fact that, okay, you know, like in the United States, we know that oil and, you know, natural resource extraction companies own politics. They run the system. They run the system in things as crass as and as obvious and as clear as campaign donations, but also like the fact that they really can say to states and municipalities like, all right, well, you want to do this, but how is a gas, you know, how is a gas tax going to look on for consumers, you know, as an example. And actually, I'm very wary of something like a gas tax. I don't think that this should be done in a regressive, top-down, austerity-driven way. So there's that kind of like, is it about really understanding how this relates to power versus like this facts versus non-facts conversation, which is not going to cover it. And then the second part is like, what are you actually telling people? Because it's sort of like, okay, clearly one way of reading the science, and particularly if you have any humanitarian concerns and you're thinking about, you know, people who could be affected by what's happening in the Himalayas, the indigenous communities, the island nations that are already seriously suffering, you know, because of this, the already, you know, it sounds more pedestrian, but frankly, think of just even people like if there's a massive heat wave in New York or in London or Paris, who dies because they can't, you know, they don't have AC. I mean, you know, like this is already playing out every day. How do you – yeah, I mean, go to the – but I just like how do you convey we have to do something about this? There's things that can be done even though they will literally be revolutionary things versus like I guess if you just took the science, you could just feel like, eh, that's a wrap.
That's a great question. I don't know if I'm qualified to answer that question because, you know, honestly, what this kind of news makes me think is like it sends me into prepper mode. Yeah. You know, I'm like, you know, we're having conversations around the house like, okay, you know, when we lived in Portland, there's a big earthquake risk there, right? So it was like, okay, let's get our earthquake kit ready. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we moved that with us and now it's kind of like a climate catastrophe kit because there's all of these phenomena that are related to climate change that are already affecting people's lives, you know, not just if you're in India, but like where we live now in Alberta, just before we went on vacation, massive wildfires. I mean, this is the regular summer thing now in much of the West. So, you know, I think part of what needs to be communicated to people is climate change is real. It's happening faster than we thought. And that means that you have to take steps in your life, in your day-to-day life to adapt.
That's another really important question, right? Because if people take some of those steps to adapt in a way that is community-minded and people are actually building bonds, like, okay, we need to adapt, so I should get to know who my neighbors are. We actually should be doing things like community organic gardens or whatever else to build community resiliency, defense. Community events, all of this type of thing.
Defense.
Community defense, whatever it is, community defense and events, whatever it is, versus, you know, I'm going to go stockpile a bunch of guns and seeds for myself. You're already prototyping two very different types of futures right there.
Yeah. Well, the people that think that they're going to like bunker down, those kind of preppers are delusional. I mean, I think there needs to be more of that kind of culture on the left that is more about community. Right. So, I mean, that's something that I imagine, you know, DSA groups or anarchist collectives could start thinking about is like, what, how do we, you know, not only the idea of like, how do you set up parallel structures to provide for people, who are not being, having their needs met by the private economy or the state. Right.
Right.
But how do you provide for people who might be displaced?
Oh, right.
Or, 'cause there will be a lot of internal displacement, and some of it will be, you know, of a more, hey, I'm not sure I want to do LA anymore because of the pollution and the fires, so I have the resources to move myself across the country. I mean, even that sort of like, you know, non-emergency, non-priority type of thing, that's still going to end up being a lot of people. And that's going to affect, you know, housing, resources. And we need to start, I mean, to me, that's another reason. This is another reason that something like the Sanders campaign is so important, because you need to start prototyping that broad sort of socially minded sense of interdependence in policy. Because if this stuff starts to play out in a heavily armed, paranoid, ultra socially isolated society, I mean,
It's scary. Yeah, it's really scary.
Well, the Socialist Rifle Association and certain branches of DSA are already doing a pretty good job at that, actually, with, I mean, the name makes it sound like they're just a bunch of socialists who shoot guns, but guns are actually a very small part of what they do and what they conceive of in terms of community defense, because, right, you have to defend people against hunger as well. You have to defend people against all sorts of things. And for a lot of people, the crisis has already begun.
Definitely.
So we are building these networks now, and we need to keep doing that.
And people should go ahead, sorry.
Oh, I wanted to say that idea of dealing with the sort of immediate consequences is one track of, you know, response that I think people need to talk about. And the other track is, you know, what scientists are saying as far as the bigger, you know, global picture of, you know, immediate stop to carbon emissions is not enough. They're saying now we need to think about actually getting CO2 out of the atmosphere, because things are happening faster than they expected and it's worse than they expected. So, that is, you know, a whole other separate conversation. So people need to figure out what, you know, does that mean geoengineering?
That's interesting, because I'm, you know, I maintain, I'm sorry, I'm not going to be, you know, I'm not going to be embracing nuclear. I just don't buy it. It's way too big of a risk, and I do not trust, you know, I just don't trust that as a solution. I'm sorry, I know it will freak a lot of people out. However, on the other hand, where I'm much more receptive, the more I think about this, and I know, like, I haven't read it yet, but Aaron Bastani's new luxury communism book, like, clearly there is going to need to be some, you know, highly technologically evolved stuff that we're not even thinking about, but is actually becoming play.
Like powering the UFOs.
Exactly.
Or asteroid mining. I mean, that sounds ridiculous. And then you look and you're like, no, Luxembourg is actually figuring out basically a licensing system on that in anticipation of like that is going to happen. So I do.
Well,
think,
we can't have Luxembourg running it. I mean, that's like that's I think that the, you know, the takeaway as far as the politics of this is that, you know, we, our generation, not our children's generation, but our generation is going to have to lead a revolution or we're all going to die. I mean, that's bottom line.
Dead ass.
And look at where the Democrats are at. Like, they're not even anywhere close. There's no candidate that is anywhere close to leveling with people about this problem. And I'm glad that some reporters are starting to ask candidates like, hey, Since we're talking about national emergencies for BS immigration problems that aren't problems, really, that we can easily absorb these people, like, what about a climate emergency?
Right.
So, I mean, that's a good step, but it needs to be more focused and more sharp of a critique that's actually in line with the science and actually in line with the phenomena that are happening around the world.
Cue Tom Perez impotently explaining to a young activist why it would be unfair to have a climate debate because that's one of the favorite one candidate. And I know it's a big deal and it's real. And we're going to talk about it and maybe propose solutions from the mid-80s for it.
I can't even laugh about that right now. It's so horrifying. It's just the worst.
It's amazingly. Yeah, it's just well, what it is pathetic. I mean, yeah.
As these crises get worse, I think that more people are going to have less time for people like Tom Perez that like not only don't know what they're talking about, but don't care to educate themselves or address the issue seriously.
Right.
Like we just don't have time for that kind of nonsense. That's my take.
It really does. And in the chapter in my book, among several things with Sam Harris, I do sort of correlate him with Steve Pinker, who isn't the prime focus of the book, but is certainly a player in this whole, you know, sort of delusion set. But I really understand, like, when you watch Steve Pinker sit down and get grilled by Mehdi Hasan, and basically saying, like, pretty much, how could you write this book with all of your credentials and all of your brand power? And essentially, in addition to, you know, painting a totally Pollyannish view of the world, which totally, you know, uses statistics in a profoundly narrow way to, you know, obscure the fact of the poverty crisis and inequality and all of these other vital things. And then that basically, when it comes to climate change, you're pretty much saying, like, hey, like, stop being so negative. Capitalism and technology are awesome and we'll probably figure it out. And Steve Pinker's basically his response is, you know, essentially like, you're being negative, Mehdi. And, you know, at the time, and of course, I think the politics and the ideology of what he's putting forward is obviously delusional and disastrous and dangerous. But, you know, when you pour into the climate stuff, you get the emotional appeal of that, of those, as Matt says, bedtime stories. It's like, yeah, and that's even why I start to actually understand why people get so emotionally triggered about Elon Musk, because he is a personal avatar of, we don't need to reckon with anything hard. There's just some guy who will, you know, just magically solve our problems like a movie. And what's funny is that, you know, even at this point, he finally comes forward with that super project, and it's literally just like, oh, you built like a small underground road. Okay, that's great. And, you know, this is obviously not going to achieve anything, but people need yeah, talk about it. But I mean, I am starting to understand more, just, you know, the emotional fixation that people have around people like Musk and Pinker is because, I mean, you're not completely, you know, you're not totally in the Trump Bolsonaro, like, yeah, just poison the rainforest. Like, who cares? Let's just destroy life on Earth. Let's just aggressively destroy humanity and Earth systems. You're there where it's like, well, I don't want to be anti-science. I want to accept that this is a real thing because science, science, science. But then I don't want to deal with any of the implications for capitalism or for, you know, anything serious. So let me just get back into like the magic gadget fantasy.
Pinker's an ideologue. Like, I think he's and the fact that he's not described as such just kind of tells you where the ideology of the sort of mainstream middlebrow press that elevated him is at well. I mean, they share it.
It's 100% capitalist realism.
Yes, it is definitely Mark Fisher's Capitalist Realism, as well as Vampire Castle, two big essays that everybody should be reading Fisher.
That goes back to Posadism as well, because, like, I think it was Mark Fisher who said it's easier for people to picture the end of the world than the end of capitalism, right? Or, as Comrade Communicator put it on our show about Posadism, it's easier for people to imagine a world that will end than a world that can change. And that's where the Posadist obsession with nuclear war comes in. Now, I feel like a lot of people misunderstand the nuclear war thing as something that they want to happen to clear the way to build communism in the ashes, whoever's left alive
really
in this nuclear winter.
Not what they want.
But no, they just think that it's going to happen. And then, you know, as a necessary stage or as a stage, right? We're not making value judgments on it. People are going to rebuild. And it makes a lot of sense when you think about climate change, right? Because climate change is another kind of disaster that could end human life on this planet. And it's putting the same kind of pressure on us right now. And that kind of crisis, hopefully without killing everybody, is probably going to be the catalyst for real changes and revolutions to actually happen in the world.
Corey, Mighty Ducks 3, what do you got for us? What should we be streaming?
I have a couple of suggestions. One, and they're very different, but one, I was on a long haul flight and my screen was broken.
Right.
And my wife in the next seat put on Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit from 2005, I think. The only feature-length Wallace and Gromit film. And these are claymation characters for anybody that's not familiar. And so I watched the whole thing. I'd seen it before, or at least once, and I watched the whole thing on mute, basically, because it was her screen. And I realized, like, it's a movie with no third act problem. Like, most movies kind of fall apart at the end, you know? Mm-hmm. But Wallace and Gromit, Curse of the Were-Rabbit is perfectly paced all the way to the very end. And it doesn't fall apart. Rather, it all sort of comes together. It's exactly what you want in a story. And I just wanted to give that plug for that movie.
Sweet.
If claymation kids movies aren't your thing, there is a movie that I was going to recommend, and then I thought, oh no, there's no reason for it. It's just a random old action movie, but it's getting remade into a streaming series on Amazon, I have discovered, and it's called Hannah. It came out in 2011. I think it was Swedish, some kind of European Hollywood co-production, but it's basically Jason Bourne with a teenage girl assassin instead of Jason Bourne.
Cool. I love the Bourne movies.
Yeah, well, this is better. I mean, you know, the first Bourne movie was great, but the other sucked. And Hannah is like, takes that sort of conceit and goes in a really fun, different direction with it. The acting is all great. Most of the actors are not famous. The villain is played by Kate Blanchett, however, and she's really good in it.
She's a great actor. And I like Kate Blanchett.
The protagonist is an Irish-American actress from the Bronx named Saoirse Ronan. And I think she's been in some bigger movies since that.
Wasn't she in Lady Bird?
Yes. And Atonement, I think, and a couple others. But she is the teen girl assassin chasing the CIA evil mastermind played by Kate Blanchett. And it's really fun. A lot of reviewers compared it to like a dark fairy tale, and it does have that sort of vibe. But it also has a lot of like light and funny moments that you don't see very often in action movies. And I heartily recommend it.
I want to see Lady Bird kill some people. I also got to say, Corey, I really enjoyed What We Do in the Shadows. I finally watched it after you recommended it for me. And it is now a TV show that I've been watching on Amazon Prime, which is absolutely hilarious. It's a vampire roommate comedy.
Yeah, the movie's very funny.
Cool. Is it the same cast? I think the streaming series of Hannah is a different cast than the movie. Yeah,
I saw the movie Hannah, too, in theaters. Actually.
I'm talking about What We Do in the Shadows.
No, I think
that
is the same
cast. But it's
right?
A different cast, right, than What We Do in the Shadows, the movie.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Oh.
Okay.
Corey, it's a pleasure, as always. Even when it's incredibly apocalyptic, it's always an incredible pleasure talking with you, my friend. And I really, as always, I'll, I, you know, live, work, 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 die is the definitive, like, treatment of Silicon Valley that is still also enjoyable to read to understand how the Silicon Valley economy works. I would say between
thank
that
you. Still itself yeah. getting shopped as a streaming series. First pitch went down, unfortunately.
But it should be. I'm actually, you know, it's I'm a bit. I think Silicon Valley's actually gotten really good, and I like that show a lot. I think more in any genre of mocking Silicon Valley, I'm happy with. And it's a great book. So buy it and also become a patron and a subscriber to Corey's News from Nowhere podcast. It's a great show. And, of course, you can hear him often on TMBS. We recently did, and I think we unlocked it, an illicit history of Deutsche Bank from Hitler to Trump, which was wild. Corey, thanks a million as always.
Thanks again. And happy Friday, everybody.
Take care.
TGIF.
Bye. Oh, let me just read this. I am... briefly, because we should have top-lined this, and it's funny. God is a woman. Michael, you beautiful bitch. Tell everyone to vote for Tiffany Caban for Queens DA on June 25th. Everybody, DAs are really, really important offices if you care about human well-being, if you care about fighting back against all of the barbarism and inequities of our criminal justice system. And my understanding is that she's absolutely the real deal. She's a public defender. She's running on an unabashed left program. You see some real gains with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia as an example. Let's bring that to Queens. Vote for Tiffany Caban for DA in Queens. Huge race. Get out there. Make that happen. All right, folks. Of course, become a member of the Majority Report today. That's how this show happens. Majority.fm. Click on the Become a Member page, patreon.com/TMBS for the Michael Brooks Show. This Sunday, we're going to unlock an illicit history of the Democratic Party with Ryan Grimm that traces his book, but also has a great, as we do it usually with illicit histories, a sort of sound arc that correlates with the historical conversation that we have from Jesse Jackson to Jerry Brown to Elizabeth Warren to Bernie Sanders, and some really interesting insights on the Sanders campaign, actually, in 2020, which could bode very well for it. Patreon.com/TMBS, Michael Brooks Show on YouTube. Jamie.
So I feel like I should plug a few episodes of the Antifada in light of what we just talked about with Corey Pine. Our episode, I believe, 2 weeks ago, I don't know time anymore. But we had on Anna Merlin recently, who was also on this show, to talk about UFOs and conspiracy theories and all that good stuff. We also got an episode of Prolit Cult out of it, where we talk further with her about UFOs. We have an episode on Posadism featuring the great Comrade Communicator that is a while back in our feed. And also, of course, we had Corey Pine on not that long ago talking about his brilliant book and Silicon Valley and all sorts of stuff. But this week on the Antifada, we had on our friend Sophie Wiener. She's the night editor at Splinter News. And we talked about a bunch of different things, but mainly her new techno zine. It's a socialist techno zine called Pluralitariat, and talked about how the sort of underground techno culture is a great space to go in and radicalize people and get them to think about the world in a new way. Also today, we released a Real Crime Think Hours, also with Sophie Wiener, wherein we read a classic Crime Think article about how the impetus to wash and quote unquote smell good is just a capitalist conspiracy to keep you down.
Boo. Wrong. Fake news. The socialist revolution will be highly showered and clean.
Yeah, if Matt, I can't bathe, I don't want to be in your revolution.
No, word. Matt, the whole point of having a revolution, frankly, is to be able to bathe multiple times a day with fewer time obligations.
With more people.
Or by yourself.
Well, speaking about bathing, Matt, with more people.
Yes, I like this. Good
tomorrow
transition.
On the Blythedale, the Blythedale Romance episode.
Matt
of Literary
and Alex Guns take a bath together.
No, but we do talk about the work of Charles Fourier, who was one of the original utopian socialists before Karl Marx came and said they were doing it wrong.
Right.
One of his ideas, he had this sort of idea that we should be driven by our passions. He's actually kind of a greed is good guy, but he also thought we should be able to follow all of our passions. He was, for instance, really into lesbians. He thought after the Communist Revolution
sort of like
happens,
Howard Stern.
He's sort of a French Howard Stern of utopian communism.
Will you ride the CBN?
No, he was apparently never pictured smiling or seen smiling.
That is really funny. Every time you read about, besides with the exception of Oscar Wilde, who really did seem like a genuinely really fun guy, there's so many people when you go into that, like the utopian streak of socialist literature, you're always just like, and then the ideal of society was that everybody would live in a never ending like game of cricket. Well, and then you look at their pictures and always like,
Posadas wanted to get rid of sex and irony and humor, so that's going to be a tough sell for a lot of people.
Yeah, so, I'm
Charles Fourier thought, I'm going
to
try to
more reasons to tap
pull
out
up an image of him, but he basically thought that once we need to develop these things called phalanxes, which is 1,620 people, and we all have different jobs, but the jobs are scheduled by like every couple of hours you do a different job. You follow the butterfly passion, which is you want to do different things. Kind
That's
of like
pretty interesting.
Kind of like the Marx thing in the German ideology about you can fish in the morning and I forget what all the examples.
And kind of like that language can also be replicated and redeployed for being a task rabbit.
Yeah, so we get into Charles Fourier, who is sort of the utopian socialist who inspired the Brook Farm that Hawthorne himself was on. This is what he looked like, by the way.
Yeah, he looked very fun.
And even like
what a snack.
This guy, Alfred Brisbane, who was...
not Howard Stern. Howard Stern looks more fun.
Yeah, he actually said like when he went and studied with him and never saw him smile a single time. So, but an interesting guy. He thought that we'd all end with like these sort of communistic orgies, and there'd be these lions would evolve into like a form of transportation. The ice caps were going to melt because of human activity, but it's actually cool because it's going to taste like lemonade. So yeah, some interesting ideas there. Oh,
exactly.
And also
it's all about
like
ideas.
Lemonade.
He's a big feminist who we wanted to liberate women.
Ideas.
Yeah, I'll take it.
All right, we'll see you in the fun half, everybody.
Left is best. Jamie and I may have a disagreement.
Yeah, you can't just say whatever you want about people just because you're rich.
I have an absolute right to mock them on YouTube.
He's up there buggy whipping like he's the boss.
I am not your employer.
You know, I'm tired of the negativity.
I'm sorry, I didn't mean to upset you. You're nervous, you're a little bit upset, you're riled up.
Yeah, maybe you should rethink your defense of that, you fucking idiots.
We're just going to get rid of you.
All right.
But dude. You want to smoke this joint?
Yes.
Do you feel like you are a dinosaur?
Some good shit.
Exactly. I'm happy now.
It's a win-win.
It's a win-win-win.
Oh, hell yeah.
Now listen to me. 2, 3, 4, 5 times. 847-906-501-457. 2, 38, 56, 27. 1/2. 5/8. 3.9 billion.
Wow.
He's the ultimate math nerd,
don't you see?
Why don't you get a real job instead of spewing vitriol and hatred, you left-wing Limbaugh?
Everybody's taking their dumb juice today.
Come on, Sammy.
Dance, dance, dance.
Ooh.
Rand Paul. I had my first post-coital scene with a woman. I'm hoping to add more moves to my repertoire. All I have is the dip and the swirl.
Fine, we can double dip.
Yes, this is a perfect moment.
No.
Wait, what?
You make under $1 million a year. You're scum. You're nothing.
Excuse me? Fuck you, you fucking liberal elite. I think you belong in jail.
Thank you for saying that, Sam. You're a horrible, despicable person.
All right, gonna take a quick break. I want to take a moment to talk to some of the libertarians out there. Take whatever vehicle you want to drive to the library. What you're talking about is jibber jabber.
Classic. I'm feeling more chill already.
Good.
Donald Trump can kiss all of our asses.
Hey, Sam. Hey, Andy. You guys ready to do some evil?
Hitler was such an idiot.
I think I might be a Nazi.
Agreed.
No.
Death to America.
You.
Yes.
Wow.
Wow, that's weird. No way! Unbelievable. This guy's got a really good hook.
Throw our hands up.
Ooh. Wow.
The
and Sam, I got to get off.
No worries. Let's. I want to just flesh this out a little bit. I mean, look, it's a free speech issue. If you don't like me,
hey, shut up.
Thank you for calling into the Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.